one of the least interesting teams on the court also happened to be one of the most interesting off the court. I'm Brian Gibberman. It's another edition of the Podium Game Podcast, and I'm joined by Jared Dubin from HP Network, Bloomberg Sports, Grantland. You can find him in all these places. Jared, what's going on?
Not too much, man. Thanks for having me back.
No, oh, thank you. I'm sure I'll be bothering you.
What's going on with you?
No, nothing much here. Just getting ready to head into work, and I wanted to talk about the 76ers a little bit.
Well, yeah. I mean, who doesn't want to talk about the 76ers?
The NFL is only starting when this will probably end up on the internet. I mean, no reason not to talk about the 76ers on that day.
I mean, they're basically the NFL equivalent of the Seahawks, so... And by that, of course, I mean the Seahawks would probably win as many NBA games as the Sixers will next season.
It's amazing. It's the dynamic of, and Sam Hinkie, who is in charge, he was a Daryl Morey protege. Did you know he worked in the NFL?
I didn't, but what I'm really interested in, Russell Wilson would be like the second, third best player on the Sixers, the third best behind Carter Williams and Noel, I think. Is that safe to say?
Yes, and the Sixers team is basically a bunch of Christine Michaels. So, if we want to keep that going. He worked for the Texans and the 49ers. He is, at least that's what Wikipedia tells me. He worked for their to help them with their draft strategy.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I mean, if we believe...
The 49ers, that makes sense.
Yeah, I was trying to think back to the Texans drafts, and it didn't even tell me the years. It just said he helped with the 49ers, and then after that was when he got hired in 05 by Morey to help out with the Rockets.
Well, the 49ers, with Jed York, they've been very big proponents of trading down from picks, which is, I think, the best strategy in the NFL, because you just want to... The draft is a crapshoot, so you give yourself as many chances as possible. That's, you know, the smart teams trade down, not up. Of course, my favorite team likes to trade up, and whatever. We're not going to talk about them. Let's talk about the Sixers.
You know what the 49ers also do is they draft injured players that aren't going to be ready till the next season.
Yep.
They've done that. They've done that on multiple occasions. So the Sixers. Where to start here? The roster... I'll say this. The roster he took over in 12-13, I think most of us would all agree we have no problem with him breaking up that team, correct?
Yeah, I don't think anybody would really argue that they had a chance to go anywhere.
So the first step of his process, trading away Drew Holiday, getting rid of Evan Turner eventually, and the core of that team, Spencer Hawes, no one really has an issue with that. They were a year departed from almost making the Eastern Conference Finals, but they made a bad move with the Bynum-Iguodala swap, and the team took a step back. So at that point, it's okay to take that next step. All right, we're going to break up this team. Now is where it gets interesting. Do you think he's gone too far down that other road?
Somewhat. In one sense, yes, but in many other senses, no. So for example, last season I was talking to a player in the locker room. I won't tell you, you know, sort of who it was or what team they were from, but we were talking about Melo's future free agency, and at the time, it wasn't the deadline yet, and I brought up that Philly had Carter Williams, who was about to win the Rookie of the Year. They had Noel coming back. They had two first-round picks, and they were going to have massive amounts of cap space. And I said, just sort of, you know, off a whim, like, why wouldn't Philly go after him? Not that he would consider going there, but why wouldn't Philly chase him and say, look at all these different assets we have? And the player just sort of laughed at me, and he said, man, they're a joke. Nobody would ever go there. So I think that you give yourself a little bit of a bad reputation when you do things like that. But also, they didn't have valuable things on the roster to begin with anyway, so you might as well go about collecting assets. They turned Drew Holiday into essentially three first-round picks, which is insane. No one would ever trade three first-round picks for him, because they turned him into Noel and a future first, and then they turn that future first into Saric and another future first. So I think that the way he's handled the assets has been good, and they're doing a good job of, you know, my philosophy on the draft, which I just discussed before, is to give yourself as many chances as possible to hit in the lottery, because the draft is such a crapshoot. But you also want to be careful to not develop too much of that type of reputation around the league. So in some respects they've maybe gone too far, but in some respects, and I think in more respects, I think they're doing things not necessarily the right way, a way that I think is smart to go about it when you don't have very valuable assets to begin with.
I kind of look at it this way. I'm with you. There's some things he does that I really like. I like the stockpiling of second round picks and just throwing darts and trying to find one that hits. Maybe you find, if you have 10 second round picks over 3 years, maybe you find two players. And that's great because of the value they are on their contract. I like some of the stuff he's done with the first round picks. I mean, Noel and Embiid have huge upside, especially on the defensive end, and room to grow on the offensive end for both players. I'm not going to pretend I know anything about Saric, but he seems, people are high on him and think he's going to be good when he comes over 2 years from now. I haven't watched him in the Worlds yet. I'm looking forward to that at some point. But I think he's also putting all of his, he's doing everything, he's putting it all in one place. Is it what you just talked about with free agency? It's like, I like chicken wings, but like, I can't eat chicken wings every day because that'd be really bad for me. And what he's doing is he's basically X'd out free agency right now as a way for him to improve that team because of how players view that organization and what they're doing. So I think that hurts them. And then you look like a team like the Magic, who are also using the draft, but they've also gotten real actual talent through trades, like they did with Vucevic and Harkless in the Bynum trade, and in the Dwight Howard trade from their perspective. And then they signed Channing Frye. So they're using multiple avenues to rebuild the team. Whether it ends up working out or not, I don't know. But they've given themselves more options than the 76ers have.
Somewhat. I think that Orlando is a little bit different because they sort of had more NBA talent on the roster to begin with when Rob Hennigan got there than the Philly team did. The Philly team, it was basically, you know, Holiday, Thad Young, Hawes, and a lot of nonsense. Orlando, they had Jameer Nelson, they had Big Baby, they had Aaron Aflalo. I think they had a little bit more to work with. And once Hinkie decided that Holiday wasn't going to be a foundational player and made that trade, I feel like it was just a matter of time before they sold off the other assets too. And I think they waited sort of as long as possible to try to get as much value from those guys as they could. I think it worked a little bit for, say, Evan Turner and Hawes. You know, they got, I think, 3 second-round picks for those guys. But it sort of didn't work for Thad Young. I think they got less for him than maybe they could have if they had dealt him at the deadline or even earlier. I want to pivot the conversation a little bit, though, because the thing that everyone brings up inevitably with the Sixers is how there's some, like, scourge on the league, and the NBA is basically considering changing the rules because the Sixers so brazenly, not flaunting them, but steering into the way the system is set up right now. But I haven't heard any argument that's convinced me yet why I should. Okay, so basically, let's work from here. Because a team will win and lose in every game, we need to accept that there will always be bad teams. And if we accept that, I don't see why I should care whether those teams are bad by accident or on purpose. You know, the Sixers were trying to be bad last year. The Bucks were trying to be good. And the Bucks were still worse than the Sixers. I don't see why I should give a shit if a team is bad on purpose or by accident. I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
Uh, I know this. You're not supposed to do this on podcasts, but I really don't have a strong opinion about the lottery thing. The Philadelphia 76ers have the right to do whatever they want as an organization, as long as, the owner says, okay, Sam Hinkie can go do whatever the hell he wants. If the league has rules in place that allow them to do that, he's within his right to do that. If the league feels it's necessary that they need to change the rules, then Sam Hinkie's going to have to find a different way to build his team. Your points are valid. I hear the other side that, they don't have, the 76ers right now don't have, because Embiid and Sarge aren't signed, don't have $1 in guaranteed salary, for the season after this year. Not one. They could get out of
it. How is that possible? What about Noel?
They can get out of those. They're team options. If they really wanted to. They don't have one guaranteed dollar.
Well, the owner, I think, Josh Harris, he comes from a private equity hedge fund background. And that's what these guys do when they buy assets, is they strip everything down and look to build up value from there. And I think that you see that in their team building philosophy. They strip everything down to the point where, rookie contracts are, other than a true superstar like LeBron, rookie contracts are the most valuable thing in the league. And if you come from a background where it's all about accumulating excess value, then that's the strategy you're going to enact. And I think it makes sense that a team owned by a hedge fund guy and run by a sort of a heavy analytics guy would pursue the strategy. I don't think you can have the conversation about this team without getting into the lottery stuff. Just because that's what everybody talks about in connection with them. And they are the reason that looking into all these changes, because the other teams don't like that they're being so brazen about it. But again, I fail to see why it should matter if a team is bad by accident or on purpose. The Bucks were just as awful to watch as the Sixers last year, and the Lakers are going to be just as awful this year to watch. And they have Kobe. Like, it shouldn't matter whether you're bad on purpose or by accident.
And I think you talk about the 76ers owner being a hedge fund and how they strip down. Hinkie's also a business guy. He went to the University of Oklahoma. He had student business, so he was in the Student Business Association. He earned his MBA from Stanford. He accepted a job from Bain and Company before he got a job offer from Bain and Company before taking a job with Bain Capital in Australia. So he has a business.
Bain Capital, like what's his name's company?
Hold on one second. Let me click on it. It's in Australia.
Why am I blanking?
It's a global alternative investment firm based in Boston, Massachusetts. So
Mitt Romney.
Is that Mitt Romney?
It's Bain Capital, right?
Let's see if I see Mitt Romney's name anywhere here. But whether that is or not.
Founded in 1984 by partners Mitt Romney, Key Coleman Andrews, and Eric Chris.
Yeah, so he has a very, it's not only sports analytics, he has a business background that probably goes somewhere with what the owners feel like. So they are all in concert with what they want to do and how they want to build this team. I'm okay with how the lottery is now. I don't think it's as desperate as people make it out to be. I mean, the teams who get the highest odds almost never get the first round pick. Get the first pick.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about it a couple years ago. I think that I don't particularly care what the system is. It doesn't really make a difference to me. And teams will always steer into whatever system it is. And there's always going to be some new problem that crops up. If they want to change it, fine, whatever. If they want to keep it, fine, whatever. It doesn't really matter. There will always be bad teams, I think, is what it sort of comes down to. And again, I don't really care if they're bad by accident or on purpose.
And as you just said, there's always going to be bad teams, and there's always going to be teams that find loopholes in the system to take advantage of. It's just going to be a different way of doing it.
Right. And, you know, even if they flatten out the lottery odds, or whatever that most recent proposal was, I think it was Zach Lowe wrote about it at Grantland, or at least I think he did.
He did. I think it was six teams being able to get, having higher odds at the first pick than three, wasn't it basically somewhere along those lines?
Something like that. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I think it just, I'm not sure how much it disincentivizes tanking. You know, it's not like they automatically get first pick now when they're tanking. I don't see why, you know, slightly lower odds would stop them from pursuing similar strategies.
Here's an interesting aspect, moving away. Do you have anything else on the lottery you want to add in before I move away from that?
Not really. I just think that, you know, that's kind of what everyone wants to talk about when you talk about the Sixers. And, you know, my question is always the same. Like, why does it matter if a team is bad on purpose or by accident? Like, was it really any worse for Sixers fans that their team won whatever it was, 17 games on purpose, than it was for Bucks fans that their team won 15 games by accident? Like, I just don't think it matters all that much if the team is going to be bad either way.
And here's an interest. Here's a part of this discussion that I want to bring in. I think Hinkie should be held to, at least I'm going to hold Hinkie to a higher standard of what the Sixers need to become because of what he's putting these fans through in these 2 years, possibly more, where they're intentionally losing games. I don't think being a second round in team and out is an acceptable result for them. I think they need to consistently play at a very high level once this actual roster construction is done for what he did to be an acceptable process.
How long do you give them for them to reach that level?
I can't answer that right now because I have no idea when he's going to actually start the movement of having pieces fit together and trying to win games versus just acquiring assets.
So what's interesting is they can possibly have four Rookie of the Years in a row from two draft classes. If Embiid doesn't play at all this year, and so they could go Carter Williams, and then Noel could possibly win this year, and then Embiid could win the next year, and then Sarge can't come over till the year after that. I think that's really interesting. What's also interesting to me is, you know, you talked about it before, Hinkie worked under Daryl Morey, who also is, you know, obviously the biggest proponent of sort of the NBA analytics movement. And Morey took the opposite rebuilding strategy. He never completely bottomed out. They treaded water for a long time, while at the same time accumulating assets to make superstar trades and free agent signings, which I think is, you know, is really interesting. But now people view Morey like, oh, Daryl just sees players as commodities. I think you've heard that a lot, especially this summer with the whole put Jeremy Lin's number on Carmelo Photoshop thing and let Chandler Parsons walk for nothing and replace him with Trevor Ariza. I think it's interesting that those two guys who worked so closely together charted completely opposite courses for their rebuild, while also having the same asset accumulation ethos.
What Morey did with the Rockets, I think, is my favorite way of rebuilding a team. How I talked about Hinkie has kind of limited the avenues he has. Morey kept all open. He kept flexibility and had a decent enough roster that they were a reasonably attractive place for free agents to sign. He had draft picks and potentially really good draft picks because of trades he made, like the Kyle Lowry moving that weird protection. And then he also had the pieces to make trades for. So he kept all three avenues open, which is, I think, the smartest thing to do because you give yourself, you have more ways to improve your team than just saying, I'm building this strictly through the draft.
I don't think Hinkie has necessarily closed off the free agency option. It's just not something that they pursue. Guys that are changing teams as free agents are probably the guys where you're looking to sort of finish off your squad when you're pursuing a draft-heavy rebuild strategy like, say, the Thunder did. Then your free agent signings are likely to be sort of the fill-in guys rather than the foundational guys. And you don't want to go after those fill-in guys on 2 or 3 year contracts until you're really ready to contend in that 2 or 3 year window. And they're just not there yet. Like, if their 2 or 3 year window is 2 or 3 years from now, why are they going to go after sort of ancillary free agent signing types that are going to have expired by the time they need them?
Because they could also, like the Cubs did with some of their pitching and Theo Epstein, where he signed a guy like Jason Hamill at a reasonable contract and then was able to flip him into another asset. So maybe...
Well, I think it's different in baseball.
Fair.
Because every team needs to have pitchers. Like, you have to have a starting rotation. The Sixers can just play their young foundational guys and then fill in with, you know, anybody. And that's essentially what they did last year. Baseball's a little bit different, especially because when you get to the deadline, contenders are going to want those kind of pitchers, especially when they're cheap. You get to the deadline in the NBA, and teams aren't necessarily going to want to trade for, I don't know, some mid-level free agent guy. That's not necessarily what the market is looking for at the NBA trade deadline. And you're not going to get much value that kind of guy. Like, maybe you can eke out... So PJ Redick got traded for like a second round pick in Tobias Harris a couple of years ago. You know, that actually turned out to be good value for Orlando, because Tobias Harris turned out to be good. But Milwaukee didn't think he was good, and that's sort of why they put him in that deal. Mid-level free agents at the deadline don't necessarily fetch that greater return as they do in baseball.
But there's also this. I mean, some of these guys, they're going to be playing next year. Really, they don't have a future in the NBA. You have some of your foundational pieces, and they're going to be playing guys that aren't NBA players, or if they are, they're bottom of the bench. Signing a couple of cheaper free agents or some sort of free agent that doesn't hurt you long term, that's not going to make you that much better, but makes you a more reasonable product to watch, isn't the worst thing to do for your fans to give them something to look at.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it better for your fans to win, let's say, you know, if you're talking about like a mid-rung veteran that would just make it more reasonable, is it better for your fans to sign a guy who's going to help you win 2 more games? Like, how much better is that really? Like, if the difference is just between going 19 and 63 or 21 and 61, and that might move you from the third to the fourth place in the lottery, like, is that really worth it?
Probably not.
Like, it's one thing if you're signing a mid-rung veteran to make the difference between being the last team in the lottery or the last team in the playoffs. But when the difference is 19 and 21 wins or, you know, whatever it may be, I just don't think it's necessarily worth it if the guy's not going to be part of your long-term plan.
What about them signing Eric Bledsoe?
There were any number of... The thing is, I don't see why Bledsoe would want to sign with them.
If all he cares about is money?
I guess, sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that all he cares about is money. I think he wants money, but there's nobody that is just going to sign... Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. Guys will sign for the most money, and they tend to do that. But I think they also want to win. Like, I don't think there's anybody that just doesn't care about winning and only wants to make the most money possible. Do you think that that's prevalent?
I'd say there's a balance to it. I'd say money is important, and then obviously if they have any competitive spirit whatsoever, they're also going to want to win while making money. So I think there's a balance to it, and as I said earlier, I think the 76ers have put them in a themselves in a spot where signing free agents really isn't much of an option for a couple years here until some of these players start to develop.
Yeah, but I think that that's fine. I don't necessarily think it's a problem that you're not going to pursue free agents until you're ready to, you know, and I think that that, look at Oklahoma City. Their biggest free agent signing since they moved to Oklahoma City is like Derek Fisher.
The Oklahoma City is also a unique situation because not every team that goes about this ends up with Russell Westbrook, Serge Ibaka in the 20s, and Kevin Durant. They got two transformative players and one of the best bigs in the NBA. And they got one at two, one in the low, high single digits, and the other in the 20s. I mean, that's not something that happens very often.
No, of course not. But if you're talking about teams that are pursuing the draft rebuild strategy, I think that they're always going to eschew, not necessarily completely, but to put off free agent signings until they're sort of ready to, if not necessarily to contend, then to make a run at the playoffs. And I think that Oklahoma City did that as well. And, you know, that's not to say that Philly is Oklahoma City. You know, certainly they don't have anyone on Kevin Durant's level. But Carter Williams was Rookie of the Year. Noel looks like a freaking beast in summer league, which doesn't matter at all, but was also really good in college. You know, it's possible that they already have two pillars of their future, you know, not on the Durant-Westbrook level, but two players who are going to be pretty good.
And the other thing is they're also relying on Noel being good and Embiid being good, who have some serious injury history that you have to be worried about. I mean, those are some high-risk, high-reward draft picks that if they don't pan out, how long is this going to go on for?
Well, I think that Embiid is more of a risk than, well, you know, Noel had one injury. It just happened to be one that kept him out all season last year. Embiid had the back, and then he had the foot, which is about the two worst injuries you can have for a big man. Noel tore his ACL on a freak play. What are you going to do, you know?
And I just wonder, I obviously haven't seen his medicals, but, I mean, he dropped in that draft. I mean, there had to be some trepidation around what was going on with that injury, because it's not like those teams ahead of them.
I think the GMs are hesitant to take a guy they know won't be able to play for half of his rookie year or more. GMs just don't have the job security to feel comfortable doing that. And that's why you see injured players drop in the draft in every league. But if a GM feels he has the security to be able to withstand that, then I think you get better value. And look at the guys that were drafted at the top of that Noel draft. Like, it's entirely possible he winds up the best player in that draft.
Yeah, that pick. And individually, I don't really have any problem with anything that Hinkie's done. It's just more when you put it all together, it's like, whoa, it's different. And maybe it's
just so brazenly executing that strategy. But I think when you take a look at the whole, what he's done with the assets available to him, he's acquired so much more value. Like, would you rather have Drew Holiday right now or Nerlens Noel, Dario Saric, and another pick? Like, I don't think it's even a question. I'd rather have Noel Saric in a pick.
No, and I love Holiday, but yeah, I
Drew Holiday at $12 million, like, what is he, you know, the 10th to 15th best point guard in the league? It's the deepest position in the league. You're going to pay that guy double-digit $1 million a year rather than have three first-round picks out of it? No way.
Yeah, I mean, when you there's no argument. You shouldn't have a counter-argument to that. Hinkie did the right thing in that situation.
That's also, like, you look at it from New Orleans' perspective, they traded three first-round picks for Drew Holiday and Omer Oshik, and now they're going to have to pay Oshik after next season. Like, would you rather have Davis, Holiday, and Oshik, or Davis, Noel, and two more picks? Like, I think it's crazy what they did.
I kind of... I like how the Pelicans team. I kind of like the Pelicans team.
I kind of like their team too, but I would like it way more if they had Davis, Noel, two picks, and then $20 extra million in cap space to get more guys.
Yes, and that would be an attractive free agent landing spot with how good Davis is. Much how LeBron can make Cleveland an attractive landing spot when Anthony Davis does what he's going to do this year, New Orleans will be an attractive landing spot.
It's not just that they lost those picks. They've also lost the opportunity costs. You know, when you have, what is it? Now I need to look at their salary sheet because I expect to pay $20 million total committed. Yeah, $20 million committed to Holiday and Oshik. So, and that put them over the cap. They actually had to make a cost-cutting move to even be able to make the Oshik trade. So, I mean, if you have... And then they made the Tyreke Evans trade also, which is a whole nother... I mean, would you rather have those three guys or Davis, Noel, Robin Lopez, three first-round picks, and an extra $30 million?
When you add in the Evans trade, it becomes even more ridiculous to me, but... I do very much like a core of Anthony Davis, Oshik, and Holiday. And I do wonder, say they kept that free agency cap space, would have they ended up with two better players than that? That might have been around what they would have ended up with anyway.
Sure. I think it's an interesting discussion. I also don't like... I'm a very big proponent of not trying to skip steps in the process, and I think that they tried to go from, you know, we have the sixth pick in the draft to Anthony Davis is 20, we need to make the playoffs. Like, you have this dude under control for 9 years. You don't have to make the playoffs in the second season. Like, take your time, keep accumulating assets, get better. They'll have a good defense now with him, Oshik, and Holiday, but I think that they could have been more. If they had just stayed the course.
But there is the business aspect. They just got a new owner. And they wanted to be good.
If Tom Benson was 20 years younger, I don't think that they necessarily would have done what they did. But he wants to win a title before he dies. Like, he's a super old dude. And it's totally understandable. And, you know, they had a mandate to improve right away. But I don't think it was necessarily the best possible course.
I think part of our problem with what New Orleans does is we don't like we didn't like Tyreke Evans. The Eric Gordon move ended up being matching that contract ended up being a bad decision. We're going back. If they would have invested this money into players we liked more and thought that team had a higher ceiling, I don't think we'd have as big of a problem with the rush to be good.
That's true. But I don't think we even know what their ceiling is anyway, because nobody knows what Davis' ceiling is. He could be Tim Duncan crossed with Kevin Garnett crossed with Dirk. Like, we have no idea how good this guy can be. He just had the best age 20 season ever. Ever.
Was it better than LeBron's?
At age 20? I think so.
Well, that's a good...
Now you're setting me into...
I'm about to bring up the basketball reference comparison page. Let's see. I want to know this now.
Anyway. Okay, so age 20 season, win shares per 48, Davis had .212, LeBron had .203. LeBron played 80 games, and Davis only played 66. But just by that one measure, Davis's was better. PER, Davis was better, 26.5 to 25.7. I don't know where you could find... you know, wins produced just as another all-in-one measure. Even if you don't want to say it was the best ever, it was in the top two or three, which is just insane. Even just by total win shares, he was third all-time for age 20 season, and he played 10 and 13 less games than the two guys ahead of him, who were LeBron and Magic freaking Johnson.
Jesus. And when you consider that coming out of college, the question was, how he was going to be as an offensive player. Everyone believed in his defense, but there was questions about his offense. It's crazy how quickly.
He hasn't even been yet the all-around destructive force that I think we all think he's going to be defensively. Like, he's been a solid defender, but he's still not totally where he can get to yet based on his athleticism and his instincts and his shot blocking ability and even his ability to generate steals. He's going to get so much better on defense.
All right, let's bring this back to the Sixers to finish it up. What I mentioned before, how do you think is a fair way to judge Hinkie going forward?
I think that you'll have to judge him on how well the five first-round picks he's going to have had in his first three seasons, or I guess six first-round picks in his first three seasons, turn out. You know, I think that ultimately he'll be judged on Carter Williams, Noel, Embiid, Sarich, and whoever he takes with those two picks next year. I think that he's going to win and lose with those six guys. That's going to be his core. And however those guys turn out is going to be his ultimate legacy with team.
Do you buy the idea that he's doing this for job security? A lot of people, I've seen people throw that out there.
How do you mean?
People think he's basically, I've read, people on Twitter have put out that the reason he's building the team this way is to kind of help his job security, and he's giving himself more, he's ensuring he keeps his job because there's no expectation. So if they're bad, he's doing his job. If he's good, he exceeded expectations and he looks good.
I think that he's doing it because he knows he has job security. I don't think that he would necessarily be choking the same course if he thought he was in danger of losing his job if they weren't good. And I think you see that with other GMs all the time. But because of the owner he's working for and their common background, like I said, in hedge funds and business management, where, you know, Josh Harris, that's what they do. They strip down companies and build up the value from there. And I think that he's charting that exact course because that's what his owner has experience with in his professional life. And I think that he's empowered to do it because he knows he has the security to do it, because the owner thinks that that's a good way to build companies, build businesses.
I'm excited to see how this works out, and it's going to take way too long, so I might as well not really be that excited about it. Because
I don't think you can argue with the way that they've accumulated value. Like, they turned Drew Holiday into three first-round picks.
Yeah, no, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more on-court production in the immediacy, and I think that's fair to ask for.
Well, I think that, okay, so if you go into each year saying every team gets one first-round pick every year, then they're right on course. You know, Carter Williams played last year. Noel will play this year. Embiid will play the next year. Plus, they could have an extra one next year. You know, they're still getting a first-round pick every year. They just happen to be pushing guys back. Just because you have two first-round picks in a year doesn't mean they necessarily both have to play in that year. I think that they're still... I'm also very firmly in the camp of give yourself as many shots as possible in the draft. And whenever they come to play, they come to play. So I guess I'm a little bit biased.
No, see, this is the funny part about this. I sound like I'm really anti-Hinkie in this podcast, but I'm really not. I agree with a lot of the concepts that he's doing. As a Knicks fan, for years I begged them, when there was no restrictions on second-round picks, to buy as many second-round picks as they possibly could and just stockpile them and hope one of them end up being good. That's essentially what the Sixers are doing without the ability to buy picks. They're finding creative ways to trade for them. And then they're taking the best value when it's there in the first round. You can't argue against that. But then I just look at the sum of what everything is, and if it doesn't end up working, he set this team back so many years with the way he's gone about building this team that it's just a real risk what he's done.
Well, let me ask you this. Like, let's say he had taken guys who could have played right away, but it also didn't work out. Like, why does it make a difference that if you accept that the players he took don't work out, why does it make a difference that they couldn't play right away if they don't work out anyway? Like, to me, it just doesn't compute.
Because you'd know those players weren't going to work out quicker and you could move on, make moves, trades. I mean, right now, they're just in a holding pattern. They could switch routes at this point if they wanted to, but that's highly unlikely. This is the way they're going about it. There's no diverting from it.
Somewhat. I mean, if you think the guy available at the spot you're at is the best value at that spot, I think you take him regardless of whether he can contribute right away, especially when you're not expecting to be good. Like, if you think Joel Embiid is the best player left on the board at the third pick in the draft, then you take it. Like, he's hurt, okay, whatever, you're not going to be good anyway. If you think Dario Saric is the best player on the board at 12, then you take him. Like, I'm very firmly of the belief that you take the best guy there and you worry about fit or when he can contribute or anything like that later on. I don't know anything about Saric other than that Danny Chow says he's going to be awesome. That's like the extent of my knowledge about him.
And look, Embiid was an absolute no-brainer pick at 3. Not a question. I think I would have taken Embiid at 1 last year. Even with the...
I would have taken Wiggins 1. I said that all year, even when everybody was on the holy shit, how can you not take Embiid number 1? I was like, you take Wiggins. I love him that much. But I also agree that Embiid was a no-brainer after Wiggins and Parker were gone.
Yeah, so I don't debate what he's done there. As I'm the same page as you with Saric. I read people who know more about international basketball than me, and they say he's going to be good. So I'm going to trust their opinions. And so 4 years from now, maybe I'd listen back to this and my questions about what Hinkie have done end up sounding really stupid. And that's fine. I've said many of stupid things before. I'm not really worried about that. It's just, I think there's a risk. The risk reward here is very high. And this better lead to consistent championship contention with all of the intentional. So how many more years do you think he's going to have to intentionally lose for them to start going where they want to go?
I think that the year before Saric comes over is their last year of purposeful losing. But I also think that what you said there with the risk reward, I also think that partly is due to the nature of the owner. You know, the way that hedge funds operate. You know, that you can take on risk depending on how great the reward is. I know you have to go soon. A lot of it, I think, has to do with the interplay between him and Josh Harris. You know, the business that he comes from.
Got anything you want to plug before we end this?
Yeah, I'm still doing all my stuff at Bloomberg. We're going to have the HP preview coming in a month, maybe month and a half or so. I'll have some stuff in Grantland's NBA preview over the next 2 months or so. Got a few things going on there. Still doing stuff at Bleacher Report as well. And then I have a weekly NFL thing at the Cauldron starting next week.
Oh, very cool. So you're right in NFL now. All right. Looking forward to that. Thank you, Jared. Always appreciate it.
Check out all 97 HP Network blogs. We're actually launching another one very soon.
Okay. Keep an eye out for that. At HP Network is the Twitter?
HPB Network.
Yep. So go. You can see that there. Jared's Twitter will have it. And I'm sure one of the 800 million people that write for it and are in the network will retweet it when it comes out. That wraps up this edition of the Podium Gay Podcast.